From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly reading Book One of the Belgariad, Pawn of Prophecy by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being a history of the War of the Gods and the Acts of Belgarath the Sorcerer, adapted from the Book of Elon. When the world was new, the seven gods dwelt in harmony, and the races of man were as one people. Belar, youngest of the gods, was beloved by the Elons. He abode with them and cherished them, and they prospered in his care. The other gods also gathered peoples about them, and each god cherished his own people. But Belar's eldest brother, Aldur, was god over no people. He dwelt apart from men and gods, until the day that a vagrant child sought him out. Aldur accepted the child as his disciple, and called him Belgarath. Belgarath learned the secret of the will and the word, and became a sorcerer. In the years that followed, others also sought out the solitary god. They joined in brotherhood to learn at the feet of Aldur, and time did not touch them. Now it happened that Aldur took up a stone in the shape of a globe, no larger than the heart of a child, and he turned the stone in his hand until it became a living soul. The power of the living jewel, which men called the Orb of Aldur, was very great, and Aldur worked wonders with it. Of all of the gods, Tarak was the most beautiful, and his people were the Angaraks. They burned sacrifices before him, calling him Lord of Lords, and Torak found the smell of sacrifice and the words of adoration sweet. The day came, however, when he heard of the Orb of Aldur, and from that moment he knew no peace. Finally, in a dissembling guise, he went to Aldur. "My brother," he said, "it is not fitting that thou shouldst absent thyself from our company and counsel. Put aside this jewel, which hath seduced thy mind from our fellowship." Aldur looked into his brother's soul and rebuked him. "Why dost thou seek lordship and dominion, Torak? Is not Angarak enough for thee? Do not in thy pride seek to possess the orb, lest it slay thee." Great was Torak's shame at the words of Aldur, and he raised his hand and smote his brother. Taking the jewel, he fled. The other gods besought Torak to return the orb, but he would not. Then the races of man rose up and came against the host of Angarak, and made war on them. The wars of the gods and of men raged across the land until near the high places of Khorim. Torak raised the orb and forced its will to join with his to split the earth asunder. The mountains were cast down and the sea came in. But Belar and Aldur joined their wills and set limits upon the sea. The races of man, however, were separated one from the others, and the gods also. Now when Torak raised the living orb against the earth, it awoke and began to glow with holy flame. The face of Torak was seared by the blue fire. In pain he cast down the mountains. In anguish he cracked open the earth. In agony he let in the sea. His left hand flared and burned to ashes. The flesh on the left side of his face melted like wax, and his left eye boiled in its socket. With a great cry, he cast himself into the sea to quench the burning. But his anguish was without end. When Torak arose from the water, his right side was still fair, but his left was burned and scarred hideously by the fire of the orb. In endless pain, he led his people away to the east, where they built a great city on the plains of Meloria, which they called Ktrol Mishrak, City of Night, for Torak hid his maiming in the darkness. The Angoraks raised an iron tower for their god, and placed the orb in an iron cask in the topmost chamber. Often, Torak stood before the cask, then fled weeping, lest his yearning to look on the orb overpower him, and he perish utterly. The centuries rolled past in the lands of the Angorak, and they came to call their maimed god Kal Torak, both king and god. Velar had taken the Elons to the north. Of all men, they were the most hardy and warlike, and Velar put eternal hatred for Angorak in their hearts. With cruel swords and axes they ranged the north, even to the fields of eternal ice, seeking a way to their ancient enemies. Thus it was until the time when Kerak Bareshoulders, greatest king of the Elorns, traveled to the Vale of Aldur to seek out Belgarath the sorcerer.
"The way to the north is open," he said. "The signs and the auguries are propitious. Now is the time ripe for us to discover the way to the City of Night and regain the orb from One Eye."
Poledra, wife of Belgarath, was great with child, and he was reluctant to leave her, but Kerak prevailed. They stole away one night to join Kerak's sons, Draz Bulnek, Algar Fleetfoot, and Riva Iron Grip. Cruel winter gripped the Northland, and the moors glittered beneath the stars with frost and steel-gray ice. To seek out their way, Belgarath cast an enchantment and took the shape of a great wolf. On silent feet, he slunk through the snow-floored forests where the trees cracked and shattered in the sundering cold. Grim frost silvered the ruff and shoulders of the wolf, and ever after the hair and beard of Belgarath were silver. Through snow and mist, they crossed into Meloria, and came at last to Tol Mishrak, finding a secret way into the city. Belgarath led them to the foot of the Iron Tower. Silently they climbed the rusted stairs which had known no step for 20 centuries. Fearfully they passed through the chamber where Torak tossed in pain-haunted slumber, his maimed face hidden by a steel mask. Stealthily they crept past the sleeping god in the smoldering darkness, and came at last to the chamber where lay the iron cask, in which rested the living orb. Kerak motioned for Belgarath to take the orb, but Belgarath refused.
"I may not touch it, lest it destroy me. Once it welcomed the touch of man or god, but its will hardened when Torak raised it against its mother. It will not be so used again. It reads our souls. Only one without ill intent, who is pure enough to take it and convey it in peril of his life, with no thought of power or position, may touch it now." "What man has no ill intent in the silence of his soul?" Kerak asked.
But Riva Iron Grip opened the cask and took up the orb. Its fire shone through his fingers, but he was not burned.
"So be it, Kerak," Belgarath said. "Your youngest son is pure. It shall be his doom, and the doom of all who follow him, to bear the orb and protect it."
And Belgarath sighed, knowing the burden he had placed upon Riva.
"Then his brothers and I will sustain him," Kerak said, "for so long as this doom is upon him."
Riva muffled the orb in his cloak and hid it beneath his tunic. They crept again through the chambers of the maimed god, down the rusted stairs, along the secret way to the gates of the city, and into the wasteland beyond. Soon after, Torak awoke, and went as always into the chamber of the orb, but the cask stood open, and the orb was gone. Horrible was the wrath of Kal Torak. Taking his great sword, he went down from the iron tower and turned and smote it once, and the tower fell. To the Angoraks he cried out in a voice of thunder,
Because you are become indolent and unwatchful, and have let a thief steal that for which I paid so dearly, I will break your city and drive you forth. Angarak shall wander the earth until Kragaska, the burning stone, is returned to me.
And then he cast down the city of night into ruin, and drove the hosts of Angarak into the wilderness, and Ketelmishrak was no more. 3 leagues off, Belgarath heard the wailing from the city, and knew that Torak had awakened.
Now will he come after us, and only the power of the orb can save us. When the hosts are upon us, Iron Grip, take the orb and hold it so they may see it.
The hosts of Angarak came, with Torak himself in the forefront. But Riva held forth the orb so that the maimed god and his hosts might behold it. The orb knew its enemy. Its hatred flamed anew, and the sky became alight with its fury. Torak cried out and turned away. The front ranks of the Angarak host were consumed by fire, and the rest fled in terror. Thus Belgarath and his companions escaped from Meloria, and passed again through the marches of the north, bearing the orb of Aldur once more into the kingdoms of the west. Now the gods, knowing all that had passed, held council, and Aldur advised them,
"If we raise war again upon our brother Torak, our strife will destroy the world. Thus we must absent ourselves from the world, so that our brother may not find us. No longer in flesh, but in spirit only, may we remain to guide and protect our people. For the world's sake it must be so. In the day that we war again, the world will be unmade."
The gods wept that they must depart. But Caldan, bull god of the Erends, asked,
"In our absence, shall not Torak have dominion?"
"Not so," Aldur replied.
"So long as the orb remains with the line of Riva Iron Grip, Torak shall not prevail."
And so it was that the gods departed, and only Torak remained. But the knowledge that the orb in the hand of Riva denied him dominion cankered his soul. Then Belgarath spoke with Kerak and his sons,
"Here we must depart to guard the orb and to prepare against the coming of Torak. Let each turn aside, as I have instructed, and make preparations."
"We will, Belgarath,"
vowed Kerak bare shoulders.
"From this day, Eloria is no more. But the Alorns will deny dominion to Torak as long as one Alorn remains."
Belgarath raised his face.
"Hear me, Torak One-Eye. The living orb is secure against thee, and thou shalt not prevail against it. In the day that thou comest against us, I shall raise war against thee. I will maintain watch upon thee by day and by night, and will abide against thy coming even to the end of days."
In the wastelands of Meloria, Kal Torak heard the voice of Belgarath, and smote about him in fury, for he knew that the living orb was forever beyond his reach. Then Kerak embraced his sons and turned away to see them no more. Dras went north and dwelt in the lands drained by River Mrin. He built a city at Boktor, and called his lands Drasnia. And he and his descendants stood athwart the northern marches and denied them to the enemy. Algar went south with his people, and found horses on the broad plains drained by the Aldur River. The horses they tamed and learned to ride them, and for the first time in the history of man, mounted warriors appeared. Their country they called Algeria, and they became nomads following their herds. Kerak returned sadly to Val-Elon, and renamed his kingdom Kerak, for now he was alone and without sons. Grimly he built tall ships of war to patrol the seas and deny them to the enemy. Upon the bearer of the orb, however, fell the burden of the longest journey.
taking his people, Riva went to the west coast of Sindaria. There he built ships, and he and his people crossed to the Isle of the Winds. They burned their ships and built a fortress and a walled city around it. The city they called Riva, and the fortress of the Hall of the Riven King. Then Balar, god of the Alhorns, caused two iron stars to fall from the sky, and Riva took up the stars and forged a blade from one and a hilt from the other, setting the orb upon its pommel. So large was the sword that none but Riva could wield it. In the wasteland of Meloria, Khal Torak felt in his soul the forging of the sword, and he tasted fear for the first time. The sword was set against the black rock that stood at the back of Riva's throne, with the orb at the highest point, and the sword joined to the rock so that none but Riva could remove it. The orb burned with a cold fire when Riva sat upon the throne, and when he took down his sword and raised it, it became a great tongue of cold fire. The greatest wonder of all was the marking of Riva's heir. In each generation, one child in the line of Riva bore upon the palm of his right hand the mark of the orb. The child so marked was taken to the throne chamber, and his hand was placed upon the orb, so that it might know him. With each infant touch, the orb waxed in brilliance, and the bond between the living orb and the line of Riva became stronger with each joining. After Belgarath had parted from his companions, he hastened to the Vale of Aldur. But there he found that Poledra, his wife, had borne twin daughters, and then she had died. In sorrow he named the elder Polgara. Her hair was dark as the raven's wing. In the fashion of sorcerers, he stretched forth his hand to lay it upon her brow, and a single lock at her forehead turned frost white at his touch. Then he was troubled, for the white lock was the mark of the sorcerers, and Polgara was the first female child to be so marked. His second daughter, fair-skinned and golden-haired, was unmarked. He called her Belderan, and he and her dark-haired sister loved her beyond all else and contended with each other for her affection. Now when Polgara and Belderan had reached their 16th year, the spirit of Valdur came to Belgarath in a dream, saying, "My beloved disciple, I would join thy house with the house of the guardian of the orb. Choose, therefore, which of thy daughters thou wilt give to the Riven King to be his wife and the mother of his line. For in that line lies the hope of the world, against which the dark tower of Torak may not prevail." In the deep silence of his soul, Belgarath was tempted to choose Polgara. But knowing the burden which lay upon the Riven King, he sent Belderan instead, and wept when she was gone. Polgara wept also long and bitterly, knowing that her sister must fade and die. In time, however, they comforted each other and came at last to know each other. They joined their powers to keep watch over Torak, and some men say that they abide still, keeping their vigil through all of the uncounted centuries. Part 1. Sindaria. Chapter 1. The first thing the boy Geryon remembered was the kitchen at Falador's farm. For all of the rest of his life he had a special warm feeling for kitchens, and those peculiar sounds and smells that seemed somehow to combine into a bustling seriousness that had to do with love and food and comfort and security and, above all, home. No matter how high Geryon rose in life, he never forgot that all of his memories began in that kitchen. The kitchen at Faldor's farm was a large, low-beamed room filled with ovens and kettles and great spits that turned slowly in cavern-like arched fireplaces. There were long, heavy work tables where bread was kneaded into loaves, and chickens were cut up, and carrots and celery were diced with quick, crisp, rocking movements of long, curved knives. When Geryon was very small, he played under those tables and soon learned to keep his fingers and toes out from under the feet of the kitchen helpers who worked around them. And sometimes, in the late afternoon when he grew tired, he would lie in a corner and stare into one of the flickering fires that gleamed and reflected back from the 100 polished pots and knives and long-handled spoons that hung from pegs along the whitewashed walls, and, all bemused, he would drift off into sleep in perfect peace and harmony with all that the world around him had. The center of the kitchen, and everything that happened there, was Aunt Paul. She seemed somehow to be able to be everywhere at once. The finishing touch that plumped a goose in its roasting pan, or deftly shaped a rising loaf, or garnished a smoking ham fresh from the oven, was always hers. Though there were several others who worked in the kitchen, no loaf, stew, soup, roast, or vegetable ever went out of it that had not been touched at least once by Aunt Paul. She knew by smell, taste, or some higher instinct what each dish required, and she seasoned them all by pinch or trace or a negligent-seeming shake from earthenware spice pots. It was as if there was a kind of magic about her, a knowledge and power beyond that of ordinary people. And yet, even at her busiest, she always knew precisely where Geryon was. In the very midst of crimping a pie crust, or decorating a special cake, or stitching up a freshly stuffed chicken, she could, without looking, reach out a leg and hook him back out from under the feet of others with heel or ankle. As he grew a bit older, it even became a game. Geryon would watch until she seemed far too busy to notice him, and then, laughing, he would run on his sturdy little legs toward a door. But she would always catch him, and he would laugh and throw his arms around her neck and kiss her, and then go back to watching for his next chance to run away again. He was quite convinced in those early years that his Aunt Paul was quite the most important and beautiful woman in the world. For one thing, she was taller than the other women on Faldor's farm, very nearly as tall as a man. And her face was always serious, even stern. Except with him, of course. Her hair was long and very dark, almost black, all but one lock just above her left brow, which was white as new snow. At night, when she tucked him into the little bed close beside her own in their private room above the kitchen, he would reach out and touch that white lock. She would smile at him and touch his face with a soft hand. Then he would sleep, content in the knowledge that she was there, watching over him. Faldor's farm lay very nearly in the center of Sindaria, a misty kingdom bordered on the west by the Sea of the Winds, and on the east by the Gulf of Kerik. Like all farmhouses in that particular time and place, Faldor's farmstead was not one building nor two, but rather was a solidly constructed complex of sheds and barns and hen roosts and dovecotes, all facing inward upon a central yard with a stout gate at the front. Along the second-story gallery were the rooms, some spacious, some quite tiny, in which lived the farmhands who tilled and planted and weeded the extensive fields beyond the walls. Faldor himself lived in quarters in the square tower above the central dining hall, where his workers assembled three times a day, sometimes four during harvest time, to feast on the bounty of Aunt Paul's kitchen. All in all, it was quite a happy and harmonious place. Farmer Faldor was a good master. He was a tall, serious man with a long nose and an even longer jaw. Though he seldom laughed or even smiled, he was kindly to those who worked for him and seemed more intent on maintaining them all in health and well-being than extracting the last possible ounce of sweat from them. In many ways, he was more like a father than a master to the 60-odd people who lived on his freeholding. He ate with them, which was unusual, since many farmers in the district sought to hold themselves aloof from their workers, and his presence at the head of the central table in the dining hall exerted a restraining influence on some of the younger ones who tended sometimes to be boisterous. Farmer Faldor was a devout man, and he invariably invoked with simple eloquence the blessing of the gods before each meal. The people of his farm, knowing this, filed with some decorum into the dining hall before each meal and sat in the semblance, at least, of piety, before attacking the heaping platters and bowls of food that Aunt Paul and her helpers had placed before them. Because of Faldor's good heart and the magic of Aunt Paul's deft fingers, the farm was known throughout the district as the finest place to live and work for 20 leagues in any direction. Whole evenings were spent in the tavern in the nearby village of Upper Grout, in minute description of the near-miraculous meals served regularly in Faldor's dining hall. Less fortunate men, who worked at other farms, were frequently seen, after several pots of ale, to weep openly at descriptions of one of Aunt Paul's roasted geese, and the fame of Faldor's farm spread wide throughout the district. The most important man on the farm, aside from Faldor, was Durnick, the smith. As Geryon grew older, and was allowed to move out from under Aunt Paul's watchful eye, he found his way inevitably to the smithy. The glowing iron that came from Durnick's forge had an almost hypnotic attraction for him. Durnick was an ordinary-looking man with plain brown hair and a plain face, ruddy from the heat of his forge. He was neither tall nor short, nor was he thin or stout. He was sober and quiet. And like most men who follow his trade, he was enormously strong. He wore a rough leather jerkin and an apron of the same material. Both were spotted with burns from the sparks which flew from his forge. He also wore tight-fitting hose and soft leather boots, as was the custom in that part of Sindaria. At first, Jernik's only words to Geryon were warnings to keep his fingers away from the forge and the glowing metal which came from it. In time, however, he and the boy became friends, and he spoke more frequently. "Always finish what you set your hand to," he would advise. "It's bad for the iron if you set it aside and then take it back to the fire more than is needful."
"And why is that?"
Geryon would ask. Durnick would shrug.
"It just is. Always do the very best job that you can," he said on another occasion, as he put a last few finishing touches with a file on the metal parts of a wagon tongue he was repairing.
"But that piece goes underneath," Geryon said. "No one will ever see it."
"But I know it's there,"
Durnick said, still smoothing the metal.
"If it isn't done as well as I can do it, I'll be ashamed every time I see this wagon go by. And I will see this wagon every day."
And so it went. Without even intending to, Jernick instructed the small boy in those solid Sindarian virtues of work, thrift, sobriety, good manners, and practicality, which formed the backbone of the society. At first Aunt Paul worried about Geryon's attraction to the smithy with its obvious dangers, but after watching from her kitchen door for a while, she realized that Jernick was almost as watchful of Geryon's safety as she was herself, and she became less concerned.
"If the boy becomes pestersome, Goodman Jernick, send him away," she told the smith on one occasion when she had brought a large copper kettle to the smithy to be patched. "Or tell me, and I shall keep him closer to the kitchen."
"Oh, he's no bother, Mistress Paul," Durnick said, smiling. "He is a sensible boy, and he knows enough to keep out in the way."
"You are too good-natured, friend Durnick," Aunt Paul said. "The boy's full of questions. Answer one, and a dozen more pour out."
"Well, that's the way of boys,"
Durnick said, carefully pouring bubbling metal into the small clay ring he had placed around the tiny hole in the bottom of the kettle.
"I was questionsome myself when I was a boy. My father and old Barl, the smith who taught me, were patient enough to answer what they could. I'd repay them poorly if I didn't have the same patience with Geryon."
Geryon, who was sitting nearby, had held his breath during this conversation. He knew that one wrong word on either side would have instantly banished him from the smithy. As Aunt Paul walked back across the hard-packed dirt of the yard toward her kitchen with her new mended kettle, he noticed the way that Jernick watched her, and an idea began to form in his mind. It was a simple idea, and the beauty of it was that it provided something for everyone.
"Aunt Paul,"
he said that night, wincing as she washed one of his ears with a rough cloth.
"Yes,"
she said, turning her attention to his neck.
"Why don't you marry Jernick?"
She stopped washing.
"What?" "I think it would be an awfully good idea." "Oh, do you?"
Her voice had a slight edge to it, and Geryon knew that he was on dangerous ground.
"He likes you,"
he said defensively.
"And I suppose you have already discussed this with him?" "No, I thought I'd talk to you about it first. At least that was a good idea. I can tell him about it tomorrow morning if you'd like."
His head was turned around quite firmly by one ear. Aunt Paul, Geryon felt, found his ears far too convenient.
"Don't you so much as breathe one word of this nonsense to Jernick, or anyone else,"
she said, her dark eyes burning into his with a fire he had never seen there before.
"It was only a thought, and a very bad one. From now on, leave thinking to grown-ups."
She was still holding his ear.
"Anything you say,"
he agreed hastily. Later that night, however, when they lay in their beds in the quiet darkness, he approached the problem obliquely.
"Aunt Paul?"
"Yes?"
"Since you don't want to marry Jernick, who do you want to marry?"
"Geryon?"
"Yes?"
"Close your mouth and go to sleep."
"Well, I think I've got a right to know."
"Geryon?"
"All right, I'm going to sleep. But I don't think you're being very fair about all this."
She drew in a deep breath.
"Very well. I am not thinking of getting married. I have never thought of getting married. And I seriously doubt that I'll ever think of getting married. I have far too many important things to attend to for any of that."
"Don't worry, Aunt Paul,"
he said, wanting to put her mind at ease.
"When I grow up, I'll marry you."
She laughed then, a deep, rich laugh, and reached out to touch his face in the darkness.
"Oh, no, my Geryon. There is another wife in store for you."
"Who?"
"Oh, you'll find out,"
she said mysteriously.
"Now, go to sleep."
"Aunt Paul?"
"Yes."
"Where's my mother?"
It was a question he had been meaning to ask for quite some time. There was a long pause, then Aunt Paul sighed.
"She died,"
she said quietly. Geryon felt a sudden wrenching surge of grief, an unbearable anguish. He began to cry. And then she was beside his bed. She knelt on the floor and put her arms around him. Finally, a long time later, after she had carried him to her own bed and held him close until his grief had run its course, Geryon asked brokenly,
"What was she like, my mother?"
"She was fair-haired,"
Aunt Paul said,
"and very young, and very beautiful. Her voice was gentle, and she was very happy."
"Did she love me?"
"Oh, more than you could imagine."
And then he cried again. But his crying was quieter now, more regretful than anguished. Aunt Paul held him closely until he cried himself to sleep. There were other children on Faldor's farm, as was only natural in a community of 60 or so. The older ones on the farm all worked, but there were three other children of about Geryon's age on the freeholding. These three became his playmates and his friends. The oldest boy was named Rundurig. He was a year or two older than Geryon, and quite a bit taller. Ordinarily, since he was the eldest of the children, Rundurig would have been their leader. But because he was an Arend, his sense was a bit limited, and he cheerfully deferred to the younger ones. The kingdom of Sindaria, unlike other kingdoms, was inhabited by a broad variety of racial stocks, Kareks, Algars, Drasnians, Erends, and even a substantial number of Tonedrens had merged to form the elemental Sindar. Erends, of course, were very brave, but were also notoriously thick-witted. Geryon's second playmate was Dorun, a small, quick boy whose background was so mixed that he could only be called a Sindar. The most notable thing about him was the fact that he was always running. He never walked if he could run. Like his feet, his mind seemed to tumble over itself, and his tongue as well. He talked continually, and very fast, and he was always excited. The undisputed leader of the little foursome was the girl Zubrat, a golden-haired charmer who invented their games, made up stories to tell them, and set them to stealing apples and plums from Faldor's orchard for her. She ruled them as a little queen, playing one against the other and inciting them into fights. She was quite heartless, and each of the three boys at times hated her, even while remaining helpless thralls to her tiniest whim. In the winter, they slid on wide boards down the snowy hillside behind the farmhouse and returned home wet and snow-covered with chapped hands and glowing cheeks as evening's purple shadows crept across the snow. Or, after Jernik the smith had proclaimed the ice safe, they would slide endlessly across the frozen pond that lay glittering frostily in a little dale just to the east of the farm buildings along the road to Upper Gralt. And if the weather was too cold, or on toward spring when rains and warm winds had made the snow slushy and the pond unsafe, they would gather in the hay barn and leap by the hour from the loft into the soft hay beneath, filling their hair with chaff and their noses with dust that smelled of summer. In the spring, they caught pollywogs along the marshy edges of the pond and climbed trees to stare in wonder at the tiny blue eggs the birds had laid in twiggy nests in the highest branches. It was Dorun, naturally, who fell from a tree and broke his arm one fine spring morning when Zubrat urged him into the highest branches of a tree near the edge of the pond. Since Rundrig stood helplessly gaping at his injured friend and Zubrat had run away almost before he hit the ground, it fell to Geryon to make certain necessary decisions. Gravely, he considered the situation for a few moments, his young face seriously intent beneath his shock of sandy hair. The arm was obviously broken, and Dorun, pale and frightened, bit his lip to keep from crying. A movement caught Geryon's eye, and he glanced up quickly. A man in a dark cloak sat astride a large black horse not far away, watching intently. When their eyes met, Geryon felt a momentary chill, and he knew that he had seen the man before, that indeed that dark figure had hovered on the edge of his vision for as long as he could remember, never speaking, but always watching. There was, in that silent scrutiny, a kind of cold animosity, curiously mingled with something that was almost, but not quite, fear. Then Dorun whimpered, and Geryon turned back. Carefully he bound the injured arm across the front of Dorun's body with his rope belt, and then he and Rundurig helped the injured boy to his feet.
"At least he could have helped us," Geryon said resentfully.
"Who?"
Rundurig said, looking around. Geryon turned to point at the dark-cloaked man, but the rider was gone.
"I didn't see anyone,"
Rundurig said.
"It hurts,"
Dorun said.
"Don't worry," Geryon said. "Aunt Paul can fix it."
And so she did. When the three appeared at the door of her kitchen, she took in the situation with a single glance.
"Bring him over here,"
she told them, her voice not even excited. She set the pale and violently trembling boy on a stool near one of the ovens and mixed a tea of several herbs taken from earthenware jars on a high shelf in the back of one of her pantries.
"Drink this,"
she instructed Dorun, handing him a steaming mug.
"Will it make my arm well?"
Dorun asked, suspiciously eyeing the evil-smelling brew.
"Just drink it,"
she ordered, laying out some splints and a linen strip.
"Ugh, it tastes awful,"
Dorun said, making a face.
"It's supposed to. Now drink it all."
"I don't think I want any more."
"Very well,"
she said. She pushed back the splints and took down a long, very sharp knife from a hook on the wall.
"What are you going to do with that?"
he demanded shakily.
"Well, since you don't want to take the medicine, I guess it'll have to come off."
"Off?"
he squeaked, his eyes bulging.
"Oh, probably right about there,"
she said thoughtfully, touching his arm at the elbow with the point of the knife. Tears came to his eyes. Dorun gulped down the rest of the liquid, and a few minutes later he was nodding, almost drowsing, on his stool. He screamed once, though, when Aunt Paul set the broken bone, but after the arm had been wrapped and splinted he drowsed again. Aunt Paul spoke briefly with the boy's frightened mother, and then had Jernik carry him up to bed.
"You wouldn't really have cut off his arm,"
Garion said. Aunt Paul looked at him, her expression unchanging.
"Oh,"
she said, and he was no longer sure.
"I think I'd like to have a word with Mistress Soubrette now,"
she said.
"She ran away when Dorun fell out of the tree,"
said Garion.
"Find her. She's hiding,"
Garion protested.
"She always hides when something goes wrong. I wouldn't know where to look for her."
"Garion," Aunt Paul said, "I did not ask if you knew where to look. I told you to find her and bring her to me."
"But what if she won't come?"
Garion hedged.
"Garion?"
There was a note of awful finality in Aunt Paul's tone, and Garion fled.
"I didn't have anything to do with it,"
Soubrette lied, as soon as Garion led her to Aunt Paul in the kitchen.
"You,"
Aunt Paul said, pointing at a stool.
"Sit."
Soubrette sank onto the stool, her mouth open and her eyes wide.
"You,"
Aunt Paul said to Garion, pointing at the kitchen door.
"Out."
Garion left hurriedly. 10 minutes later, a sobbing little girl stumbled out of the kitchen. Aunt Paul stood in the doorway, looking after her with eyes as hard as ice.
"Did you thrash her?"
Garion asked hopefully. Aunt Paul withered him with a glance.
"Of course not. You don't thrash girls."
"I would have,"
Garion said, disappointed.
"What did you do to her?"
"Don't you have anything to do?"
"No, not really."
And that, of course, was a mistake.
"Good,"
Aunt Paul said, finding one of his ears.
"It is time you started to earn your way. You will find some dirty pots in the scullery. I'd like to have them scrubbed."
"Well, I don't know why you're angry with me,"
Garion objected, squirming.
"It wasn't my fault that Dorun went up that tree."
"The scullery, Garion.
Now."
The rest of that spring and the early part of the summer were quiet. Dorun, of course, could not play until his arm mended, and Soubrette had been so shaken by whatever it was that Aunt Paul had said to her that she avoided the two other boys. Garion was left with only Runderig to play with, and Runderig was not bright enough to be much fun. Because there was really nothing else to do, the boys often went into the fields to watch the hands work and to listen to their talk. As it happened, during that particular summer, the men on Faldor's farm were talking about the Battle of Vomimbre, the most cataclysmic event in the history of the West. Garion and Runderig listened enthralled as the men unfolded the story of how the hordes of Khal Torak had quite suddenly struck into the West some 500 years before. It had all begun in 4865, as men reckoned time in that part of the world, when vast multitudes of Murgos and Nadraks and Tuls had struck down across the mountains of the eastern escarpment into Trestnia, and behind them in endless waves had come the uncountable numbers of the Malorians. After Drasnia had been brutally crushed, the Angoraks had turned southward onto the vast grasslands of Algra, and had laid siege to that enormous fortress called the Algerian Stronghold. The siege had lasted for 8 years, until finally, in disgust, Kaol Torak had abandoned it. It was not until he turned his army westward into Ulgoland that the other kingdoms became aware that the Angorak invasion was directed not only against the Elorns, but against all of the West. In the summer of 4875, Kaol Torak had come down upon the Arendish plain before the city of Vomimbre, and it was there that the combined armies of the West awaited him. The Sindars, who participated in the battle, were a part of the force under the leadership of Brand, the Raven Warder. That force, consisting of Ravens, Sindars, and Asturian Erends, assaulted the Angorak rear after the left had been engaged by the Algars, Drasnians, and Ulglos, the right by Tolnedrans and Kereks, and the front by the legendary charge of the Mimbrate Erends. For hours the battle had raged until, in the center of the field, Brand had met in a single combat with Kaol Torak himself. Upon that duel had hinged the outcome of the battle. Although 20 generations had passed since that titanic encounter, it was still as fresh in the memory of the Sindarian farmers who worked on Faldor's farm as if it had happened only yesterday. Each blow was described, each feint and parry. At the final moment, when it seemed that he must inevitably be overthrown, Brand had removed the covering of his shield, and Kaol Torak, taken aback by some momentary confusion, had lowered his guard and had been instantly struck down. For Underig, the description of the battle was enough to send his Arendish blood seething. Geryon, however, found that certain questions had been left unanswered by the stories.
"Why was Brand's shield covered?"
he asked Kralto, one of the older hands. Kralto shrugged.
"Just was. Everyone I've ever talked with about it agrees on that."
"Was it a magic shield?"
"May have been. But I've never heard anyone say so. All I know is that when Brand uncovered his shield, Kaol Torak dropped his own shield, and Brand stabbed his sword into Kaol Torak's head. Through the eye. Or so I'm told."
Geryon shook his head stubbornly.
"I don't understand. How could something like that have made Kaol Torak afraid?"
"I can't say. I've never heard anyone explain it," Kralto told him.
Despite his dissatisfaction with the story, Geryon quite quickly agreed to Rundrig's rather simple plan to reenact the duel. After a day or so of posturing and banging at each other with sticks to simulate swords, Geryon decided that they needed some equipment to make the game more enjoyable. 2 kettles and 2 large pot lids mysteriously disappeared from Aunt Paul's kitchen, and Geryon and Rundrig, now with helmets and shields, repaired to a quiet place to do war upon each other. It was all going quite splendidly until Rundrig, who was older, taller, and stronger, struck Geryon a resounding whack on the head with his wooden sword. The rim of the kettle cut into Geryon's eyebrow, and the blood began to flow. There was a sudden ringing in Geryon's ears, and a kind of boiling exaltation surged up in his veins as he rose to his feet from the ground. He never knew afterward quite what had happened. He had only sketchy memories of shouting defiance at Kaol Torak in words which sprang to his lips, and which even he did not understand. Blenderig's familiar and somewhat foolish face was no longer the face before him, but rather was replaced by something hideously maimed and ugly. In a fury, Geryon struck at that face again and again, with fire seething in his brain. And then it was over. Poor Rundrig lay at his feet, beaten senseless by the enraged attack. Geryon was horrified at what he had done, but at the same time there was the fiery taste of victory in his mouth. Later, in the kitchen,
where all injuries on the farm were routinely taken, and Paul tended their wounds with only minimal comments about them. Runderig seemed not to be seriously hurt, though his face had begun to swell and turn purple in several places, and he had difficulty focusing his eyes at first. A few cold cloths on his head and one of Aunt Paul's potions quickly restored him. The cut on Geryon's brow, however, required a bit more attention. She had Durnick hold the boy down, and then she took needle and thread and sewed up the cut as calmly as she would have repaired a rip in a sleeve, all the while ignoring the howls from her patient. All in all, she seemed much more concerned about the dented kettles and battered pot lids than about the war wounds of the two boys. When it was over, Geryon had a headache and was taken up to bed.
"At least I beat Khal Torak," he told Aunt Paul somewhat drowsily.
She looked at him sharply.
"Where did you hear about Torak?" she demanded.
"It's Khal Torak, Aunt Paul,"
Geryon explained patiently.
"Answer me. The farmers were telling stories, old Kralto and the others, about Brand and Fomimbre and Khal Torak and all the rest. That's what Runderig and I were playing. I was Brand. He was Khal Torak. I didn't get to uncover my shield, though. Runderig hit me on the head before we got that far."
"I want you to listen to me, Geryon. And I want you to listen carefully. You are never to speak the name of Torak again."
"It's Khal Torak, Aunt Paul,"
Geryon explained again.
"Not just Torak."
Then she hit him, which she had never done before. The slap across his mouth surprised him more than it hurt, for she did not hit very hard.
"You will never speak the name of Torak again. Never," she said. "This is important, Geryon. Your safety depends on it. I want your promise."
"Well, you don't have to get so angry about it,"
he said in an injured tone.
"Promise."
"All right, I promise. It was only a game."
"And a very foolish one. You might have killed Runderig."
"Well, why about me?"
Geryon protested.
"You were never in any danger. Now, go to sleep."
And as he dozed fitfully, his head light from his injury and the strange, bitter drink his aunt had given him, he seemed to hear her deep, rich voice saying,
"Geryon, my Geryon, you are too young yet."
And later, rising from deep sleep as a fish rises toward the silvery surface of the water, he seemed to hear her call,
"Father, I need you."
Then he plunged again into a troubled sleep, haunted by a dark figure of a man on a black horse, who watched his every movement with a cold animosity, and something that hovered very near the edge of fear. And behind that dark figure, he had always known to be there, but had never overtly acknowledged, even to Aunt Paul, the maimed and ugly face he had briefly seen, or imagined, in the fight with Runderig, loomed darkly, like the hideous fruit of an unspeakably evil tree. Chapter 2. Not long after, in the endless noon of Geryon's boyhood, the storyteller appeared once again at the gate of Faldur's farm. The storyteller, who seemed not to have a proper name as other men did, was a thoroughly disreputable old man. The knees of his hose were patched and his mismatched shoes were out at the toes. His long-sleeved woolen tunic was belted about the waist with a piece of rope, and his hood, a curious garment not normally worn in that part of Sindaria, and one which Geryon thought quite fine, with its loosely fitting yoke covering shoulders, back, and chest, was spotted and soiled with spilled food and drink. Only his full cloak seemed relatively new. The old storyteller's white hair was cropped quite close, as was his beard. His face was strong, with a kind of angularity to it, and his features provided no clue to his background. He did not resemble Erend, nor Kerik, Algor, nor Drasnian, Riven, nor Tolnedrin, but seemed rather to derive from some racial stock long since forgotten. His eyes were a deep and merry blue, forever young and forever full of mischief. The storyteller appeared from time to time at Faldor's farm, and was always welcome. He was, in truth, a rootless vagabond who made his way in the world by telling stories. His stories were not always new, but there was in his telling of them a special kind of magic. His voice could roll like thunder, or hush down into a zephyr-like whisper. He could imitate the voices of a dozen men at once, whistle so like a bird that the birds themselves would come to him to hear what he had to say. And when he imitated the howl of a wolf, the sound of it could raise the hair on the backs of his listeners' necks and strike a chill into their hearts like the depths of a Drasnian winter. He could make the sound of rain and of wind, and even, most miraculously, the sound of snow falling. His stories were filled with sounds that made them come alive, and through the sounds and the words with which he wove the tales, sight and smell and the very feel of strange times and places seemed also to come to life for his spellbound listeners. All of this wonder he gave freely in exchange for a few meals, a few tankards of ale, and a warm spot in the hay barn in which to sleep. He roamed about the world seemingly as free of possessions as the birds. Between the storyteller and Aunt Pol, there seemed to be a sort of hidden recognition. She had always viewed his coming with a kind of wry acceptance, knowing, it seemed, that the ultimate treasures of her kitchen were not safe so long as he lurked in the vicinity. Loaves and cakes had a way of disappearing when he was around, and his quick knife, always ready, could neatly divest the most carefully prepared goose of a pair of drumsticks and a generous slab of breast meat with three swift slices when her back was turned. She called him Old Wolf, and his appearance at the gate of Faldor's farm marked the resumption of a contest which had obviously been going on for years. He flattered her outrageously, even as he stole from her. Offered cookies or dark brown bread, he would politely refuse, and then steal half a plateful before the platter had moved out of his reach. Her beer pantry and wine cellar might as well have been delivered into his hands immediately upon his appearance at the gate. He seemed to delight in pilferage, and if she watched him with steely eye, he found quite easily a dozen confederates willing to sack her kitchen in exchange for a single story. Lamentably, among his most able pupils was the boy Geryon. Often driven to distraction by the necessity of watching at once an old thief and a fledgling one, Aunt Pol would arm herself with a broom and drive them both from her kitchen with hard words and resounding blows, and the old storyteller laughing would flee with the boy to some secluded place where they would feast on the fruits of their pilferage, and the old man, tasting frequently from a flagon of stolen wine or beer, would regale his student with stories out of the dim past. The best of stories, of course, were saved for the dining hall when, after the evening meal was over and the plates had been pushed back, the old man would rise from his place and carry his listeners off into a world of magical enchantment. "Tell us of the beginnings, my old friend," Faldor, always pious, said one evening, "and of the gods." "Of the beginnings and the gods," the old man mused. "A worthy subject, Faldor, but a dry and dusty one."
"I have noticed that you find all subjects dry and dusty, Old Wolf," Aunt Pol said, going to the barrel and drawing off a tankard of foamy beer for him. He accepted the tankard with a stately bow.
"It is one of the hazards of my profession, Mistress Pol," he explained.
He drank deeply, then set the tankard aside. He lowered his head, in thought for a moment, then looked directly, or so it seemed,
at Geryon. And then he did a strange thing which he had never done before when telling stories in Faldor's dining hall. He drew his cloak about him and rose to his full height.
"Behold,"
he said, his voice rich and sonorous.
"At the beginning of days made the gods the world, and the seas, and the dry land also. And cast they the stars across the night sky, and did set the sun and his wife the moon in the heavens to give light unto the world. And the gods caused the earth to bring forth the beasts, and the waters to bud with fish, and the skies to flower with birds. And they made men also, and divided men into peoples. Now the gods were seven in number, and were all equal. And their names were Belar, and Caldan, and Nedra, and Issa, and Mara, and Aldur, and Torak." Geryon knew the story, of course. Everyone in that part of Sindaria was familiar with it, since the story was of Alorn origin, and the lands on three sides of Sindaria were Alorn kingdoms. Though the tale was familiar, however, he had never before heard it told in such a way. His mind soared, as in his imagination the gods themselves strode the world in those dim, misty days when the world was first made, and a chill came over him at each mention of the forbidden name of Torak. He listened intently as the storyteller described how each god selected a people. For Belar, the Elorns. For Issa, the Naissins. For Caldan, the Erens. For Nedra, the Tonedrans. For Mara, the Marags, which are no more. And for Torak, the Angaraks. And he heard how the god Aldur dwelt apart and considered the stars in his solitude, and how some very few men he accepted as pupils and disciples. Geryon glanced at the others who were listening. Their faces were rapt with attention. Jonik's eyes were wide, and old Kralto's hands were clasped on the table in front of him. Faldor's face was pale, and tears stood in his eyes. Aunt Paul stood at the rear of the room. Though it was not cold, she too had drawn her mantle about her and stood very straight, her eyes intent. "And it came to pass," the storyteller continued, "that the god Aldur caused to be made a jewel in the shape of a globe. And behold, in the jewel was captured the light of certain stars that did glitter in the northern sky. And great was the enchantment upon the jewel, which men called the Orb of Aldur. For with the orb could Aldur see that which had been, that which was, and that which was yet to be."
Geryon realized he was holding his breath, for he was now completely caught up in the story. He listened in wonder as Torak stole the orb, and the other gods made war on him. Torak used the orb to sunder the earth, and let in the sea to drown the land, until the orb struck back against misuse by melting the left side of his face, and destroying his left hand and eye. The old man paused and drained his tankard. Aunt Paul, with her mantle still close about her, brought him another, her movements somehow stately, and her eyes burning.
"I've never heard the story told so," Durnig said softly.
"It is a book of Elorn. It's only told in the presence of kings," Kralto said, just as softly. "I knew a man once had heard it at the king's court at Sindar, and he remembered some of it. Oh, I've never heard it all before, though."
The story continued, recounting how Belgarath the sorcerer led Kerak and his three sons to regain the orb 2,000 years later, and how the western lands were settled and guarded against the hosts of Torak. The gods are removed from the world, leaving Riva to safeguard the orb in his fortress on the Isle of the Winds. There he forged a great sword and set the orb in its hilt. While the orb remained there and the line of Riva sat on the throne, Torak could not prevail. Then Belgarath sent his favorite daughter to Riva to be a mother to the kings, while his other daughter remained with him and learned his art, for the mark of the sorcerers was upon her. The old storyteller's voice was now very soft as his ancient tale drew it to its close.
And between them did Belgarath and his daughter, the sorceress Purgara, set enchantments to keep watch against the coming of Torak. And some men say they shall abide against his coming, even though it be until the very end of days. For it is prophesied that one day shall maimed Torak come against the kingdoms of the West to reclaim the orb which he so dearly purchased, and battle shall be joined between Torak and the fruit of the line of Riva. And in that battle shall be decided the fate of the world. And then the old man fell silent and let his mantle drop from about his shoulders, signifying that his story was at an end. There was a long silence in the hall, broken only by a few faint sputters from the dying fire and the endless song of frogs and crickets in the summer night outside. Finally, Faldor cleared his throat and rose, his bench scraping loudly on the wooden floor.
"You have done as much honor tonight, my old friend," his voice thick with emotion. "This is an event we will remember all our lives. You have told us a kingly story, not usually wasted on ordinary people."
The old man grinned then, his blue eyes twinkling.
"I haven't consorted with many kings of late, Faldor," he laughed. "They all seem to be too busy to listen to the old tales, and a story must be told from time to time if it's not to be lost. Besides, who knows these days where a king might be hiding?"
They all laughed at that and began to push back their benches, for it was growing late and time for those who must be up with the first light of the sun to seek their beds.
"Will you carry a lantern for me to the place where I sleep, boy?" the storyteller asked Geryon.
"Gladly,"
Geryon said, jumping up and running into the kitchen. He fetched down a square glass lantern, lighted the candle inside of it from one of the banked kitchen fires, and went back into the dining hall. Faldor was speaking with the storyteller. As he turned away, Geryon saw a strange look pass between the old man and Aunt Paul, who still stood at the back of the hall.
"Are we ready then, boy?"
the old man asked as Geryon came up to him.
Whenever you are,"
Geryon replied, and the two of them turned and left the hall.
"Why is the story unfinished?"
Geryon asked, bursting with curiosity.
"Why did you stop before we found out what happened when Torak met the Riven King?"
"That is another story," the old man explained.
"Will you tell it to me sometime?"
The old man laughed.
"Torak and the Riven King have not as yet met, so I can't very well tell it, can I? At least not until after their meeting."
"It's only a story, isn't it?"
Geryon objected.
"Is it?"
The old man removed a flagon of wine from under his tunic and took a long drink.
"Who's to say what's only a story, and what's truth disguised as a story?"
"It is only a story,"
Geryon said stubbornly, suddenly feeling very hard-headed and practical like any good Sindar.
"It can't really be true. Why, Belgarath the sorcerer would be, I don't know how old, and people don't live that long."
7,000 years, the old man said.
"What?"
"Belgarath the sorcerer is 7,000 years old. Perhaps a bit older.